This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Cincinnati region knows all too well the opportunities and struggles of being located near a major body of water. Our next guest spent 2 years traveling much of the country, investigating governments and neighborhoods' tenuous relationship with similar bodies. I spoke earlier with journalist and author Tyler Kelly about his new book, Holding Back the River, The Struggle Against Nature on America's Waterways. Here is our recorded conversation. Tyler Kelly is a journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the New Yorker, among other publications. He's also the author of the new book, Holding Back the River, The Struggle Against Nature on America's Waterways. Tyler joins us via Zoom. Thank you so much for being with us, Tyler.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, the river plays a big role in our lives. Here in Cincinnati and northern Kentucky, it's our border. A lot of our history is traced to it. A lot of our presence is connected to that as well. What attracted you to rivers?
I grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, so I always was sort of aware of big rivers. And you'd maybe surprised to hear that many people on the coast are not aware that there are these big rivers. But I was really interested, or my interest was sparked when I learned that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, you know, this one governmental agency, had proposed to really try to manage, control, you know, tame these tremendously powerful natural forces for, you know, kind of the benefit of society, to protect people from floods, to facilitate commerce, you know. And just sort of the sheer ambition and hubris of that undertaking. Once I sort of wrapped my head around that, I was just baffled, you know, that someone was even trying to do that, that we, United States, you know, was trying to do that. And so that led me into all kinds of investigations and all kinds of reporting, sort of the most dynamic of which hopefully made it into the book.
Well, I have a lot of questions about the Army Corps of Engineers, and I'm hopeful that you will answer them for our listeners, because we're familiar with the agency very loosely, maybe broadly, because they're referenced a lot anytime a major project is coming to the Ohio River here in Cincinnati and northern Kentucky. It's a project that first has to receive some sort of analysis by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. It often is the least exciting part of whatever project has been announced. It takes the longest, and it can be difficult to understand for the layman. So what is the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers?
Right. So initially, I mean, it's a department within the United States Army. So it is part of the military. It has a mostly civilian workforce, however. And really, it's sort of the, waterway construction arm of the federal government. So whenever Congress decides to build something having to do with rivers, at least, you know, kind of in the East, the Army Corps is going to do it. So now they're in the business of, you know, ecosystem restoration, water supply, navigation, flood control. Those are sort of the two essential missions of the organization. But in essence, for the public, you can just think, if someone's going to do something with the river, it's either going to be the Army Corps of Engineers, or you're going to need a permit from the Army Corps of Engineers to do it, on any kind of sizable waterway, probably east of the 100th Meridian. That's the simplest way to put it. And I think what you were asking about specifically is probably the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, which is this quite lengthy and cumbersome review process that if you do anything to a river, you have to go into this NEPA process. And the Corps just happens to be the agency sort of overseeing these NEPA applications. But that's really, you know, again, Congress passed this National Environmental Policy Act, which requires all these things to happen. And the Corps is just the agency that, you know, kind of manages that. So I think in many instances, the Corps kind of gets a bad rap for things that happen that really are at the behest of Congress. And when Congress is, you know, inept or short-sighted, you know, I think the public sometimes encounters that in the form of the Corps, if that makes sense.
Sure.
And, you know, when Congress is really smart and, you know, forward-thinking, maybe the same is true. Although people don't tend to people don't tend to, you know, get up in arms when something works just the way it's supposed to work, right?
No, that's for sure, certainly. But speaking of Congress, one house in Congress, the Senate, has approved a pretty massive infrastructure bill. And I have to say, as it relates to our area, Senator Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader who represents Kentucky, sent out a lengthy release after he voted in favor of this infrastructure, highlighting all of the areas of infrastructure that could possibly benefit should the whole package be adopted and made law. And he very specifically talked about dams. And you also paid attention to a dam that's on the Illinois and Kentucky border at the end of the Ohio River. Would you take us there and talk about why it caught your eye?
Sure. And so it's called Olmsted Locks and Dams, and it's way down at the tail end of the Ohio, almost at Caro, you know, which is the confluence. And I was interested in it for two reasons, really. One is that it was built to replace these two really old locks and dams called Lock and Dam number 53 and 52. And so I spent a lot of time with the guys tasked with maintaining and operating these antiquated dams. And we're talking about wooden panels lifted by hand off the river bottom. And that's what holds back the water, this series of panels. And then there's a steam powered crane that assists in the lifting of these panels. So not only is that really difficult and dangerous work in ideal circumstances, but this whole place was built in 1929, 28, and really hadn't been much maintained. And so they're doing this backbreaking, strenuous work, and this stuff is falling apart as they go. So they'll do this really difficult procedure to pick up one of these panels, and it'll just break off the river bottom and fall into the, you know, frothing Ohio. So that sort of scene there, you know, a critical bottleneck in the United States, you know, economy in terms of supply chains, and a really, really decrepit piece of aging infrastructure. And so the answer to that is build a new dam, right? Build a new lock. And that was this Olmsted project. And so it made sense to everybody to replace these aging locks. But the problem was that the replacement took 25 years and cost $3 billion, give or take. And so I think nobody is really happy with that cost and that amount of time. So I sort of documented that whole situation as Olmsted came online, which it did in the end of 2018, end of the summer. And as the other places were falling apart and then being decommissioned, I wrote about that as well. And so that moment interested me for many reasons, both in terms of the past, you know, what our infrastructure had looked like, and in terms of the future, because I spoke with, you know, the Secretary of the Army for Civil Works at the time. I spoke with the Chief of the Corps and basically said, this is not a viable precedent. You know, you can't do this again. You have to build a lot more structures, as we all know, and I'm sure as Senator McConnell referred to in his release, and it can't take 25 years and each one can't cost $3 billion. And they didn't really have a satisfactory answer, but.
Well, I mean, that's pretty scary to know that there's not what you would call a satisfactory answer, because what are the stakes should something like that fail? A piece of infrastructure that.
Sure. I mean, and before Olmsted was completed, these old locks were failing, you know, on a monthly basis. So you're really talking about delay, and delay equates to basically higher shipping costs, which is passed on to producers and consumers. So, you know, farmers are paid less for their crops at the grain elevator, at the river terminal. You know, the prices of fuel, chemicals, plastic, fertilizer, all these, you know, sort of raw materials, bulk commodities that move on the river, a lot of which are traded internationally. The price of all that is either going to go up for the buyer or the producer or both if we have these delays, shutdowns, that kind of thing in the river. So I was fascinated to learn, you know, when a lock goes down just for, I don't know, a day or two in Ohio, there's, you know, Japanese soybean buyers calling tugboat companies, you know, based in St. Louis asking, hey, when is my barge going to get here? What's going on with you guys? You know, and it really ripples across the world.
And we are talking with Tyler Kelly. He's the author of the new book, Holding Back the River, The Struggle Against Nature on America's Waterways. I recall the Suez Canal clog that happened recently, and we were all watching that as it impacted the global supply chain. But in looking over this book, I realized that we seem to take for granted the amount of commerce that still takes place on our rivers. And, you know, as I mentioned, we've got the Ohio River here between Cincinnati and northern Kentucky. We see barges all day long, but perhaps our relationship with that river is just, I got to get across to work in Cincinnati and then across again back home to Kentucky. What kind of commerce is taking place on our rivers? And do you think we fully grasp how significant it is?
I don't think we do. And I think it's because, you know, raw materials are not what you buy at the store. And so people have a hard time imagining how this raw material is converted into what you buy at the store. So, you know, a lot of meat, cows, pigs are fed with grain that is grown, you know, in the American breadbasket, the heartland, all through the Mississippi and Ohio valleys. So that grain feeds livestock. It also is turned into a lot of processed foods involving corn, involving soybeans. So a lot of things on the shelves at your local grocery store are made out of those soybeans and those corn. But because you don't, you know, buy, at least not in the United States, buy soybeans and pop them in your mouth, I think people don't understand how vital those soybeans, those corn, et cetera, are to a lot of the products that they're used to buying on the shelves. And I think the coronavirus had an interesting effect on people's awareness of supply chains, of, you know, what it takes to move something from, you know, a port on the coast to their local supermarket. So maybe people are thinking more about it, but no, I don't think people are aware of how the things that move on the river impact their lives.
Well, it seems like such an old way of doing things because, you know, the local region's connection to the river goes back to its founding. And yet, of course, it's still extraordinarily significant, even though, as you know, we're not popping soybeans directly in our mouths. So on an individual level, we may not recognize it, but certainly on a larger scale, we do. I want to go back just to infrastructure very quickly, because, you know, there appears to be the potential for a lot of money to be flooding the country for a lot of projects. And I'm wondering what you learned on this voyage, this 2-year project you conducted in creating this book, about the way we respond to infrastructure. Because are there concerns that when we see something broken in need of repair, that we're just building it again the same old way instead of preparing for the future?
Absolutely. And that's something I really didn't know until I had done the work that went into my book. You know, and you hear this refrain, crumbling infrastructure. And I came to really sort of object to that framing, because to me, that implies that we need to rebuild everything we had in 1950 or make it bigger, make it stronger, make more of it. And I think that really is not the right way to respond to the changes in the climate and to the changes in the values and culture of the United States. And so I do worry whenever a bunch of money is pumped into something that it's very tempting. You know, politicians like to spend money, construction companies, federal agencies like the Corps of Engineers, they love to spend money building things. But I do think, and I hope, there will be sort of a thoughtful process, maybe what I call a reimagining. And that word does appear in some of these bills, encouragingly, of what we need before we start to build. And I think there are several, or maybe a lot of different structures that would be, it would benefit us to take them down. So, you know, what's the benefit of deconstructing something? And, you know, looking at this structure and saying, does it serve the purposes it was built to serve? Or is the reason this was built, do we still believe in that? Do we still even want that thing that we built this to do for us? You know? And I think those questions need to be asked a lot more. The Army Corps generally builds things to last 50 years. It's, you know, in engineering, you call it a design life, 50-year design life. And I really think when a project is authorized, there should be sort of a clause in that language that says, in 50 years, let's go back and look at this thing and see, did it deliver the benefits that we said it was going to deliver compared with the cost? is it still serving the public good? You know, is it still benefiting us in the way we thought it was going to? And then if it isn't, let's modify it or take it down. I think that would be a really beneficial approach to infrastructure, because you see all over the country, the Army Corps of Engineers, and that's just the infrastructure that I deal with, but I'm sure this is all over in other categories as well. They're sort of burdened with these outmoded projects that really don't serve a federal interest, a federal need anymore. But because you need congressional language to deauthorize something, they're spending taxpayer money maintaining, staffing, a bunch of things that nobody needs. So I think you could trim that out and you'd really have a lot of benefits from that.
Tyler, when we hear about climate change, we mostly hear about the oceans as it relates to bodies of water. The ocean's risen this much, or it's warmed this much over a certain period of time. What do we need to know about climate change and the rivers based on what you've learned?
Simply put, there's more rain, at least east of the 100th meridian. There's more snow, there's more rain. So the rivers are higher more often. The rain is falling in more intense bursts, extreme events, which leads to flash flooding. So I think we need to prepare for that, simply put. The assumptions we've made about a 100-year flood is so high, a 500-year flood is so high, I think all those should probably be reevaluated. And I think we need to think a lot harder about which areas we need to protect, and those should be fortified, additionally. But also, I think you can limit the risk, you can diminish the risk by also thinking about which areas can we flood in a controlled way for, a short duration and still basically live life the way we want to live it. I mean, we, the American people or whatever. So I think there's a lot of areas, probably farmland, that you could allow to take water when the river's high, just, for a couple of weeks in the spring, maybe every 5 years or something like that. There's a project like this in California that I really like and I think is really exemplary. But allowing our land to flood in a controlled way, I'm not talking about people's homes. That also, I think, is a really progressive and smart approach. So as we think about, okay, we're going to do things differently, we should think, what do we need to protect? What can we afford to get wet? What can we let get wet?
A 100-year flood and that type of definition is of particular importance to this region, and it does seem like they happen a little more often than they used to. Are those conversations taking place anywhere? You mentioned a project in California, but is it not happening on the scale that it should?
I'm not sure. I encountered an interesting kind of disconnect, I guess, when I was reporting my book between what the Army Corps of Engineers has some really smart people working there, brilliant scientists, and they have studied a lot of things. But what they need in order to implement their findings or in order to conduct the research that they would like to conduct is, again, congressional authorization. And so the question is, has Congress authorized the Corps to reevaluate the risk to the Ohio Valley, to the Mississippi Valley from, extreme weather events? And there was some interesting language along those lines, not actually in this infrastructure bill, but in one that was passed in December. There was a water resources bill in December that was really had some pretty progressive stuff in it. And that didn't get any attention for some reason. But I guess I am encouraged. I do think the Army Corps of Engineers and Congress is probably aware that these reevaluations need to take place, but the results of those reevaluations are a long ways off, I think. And I think it could get pretty political and pretty controversial.
Tyler Kelly spent 2 years traveling across the country, getting to know a lot of different people in what is so-called flyover country, including some time on the Ohio River. It's a fascinating book that he reported, Holding Back the River, The Struggle Against Nature on America's Waterways. Tyler, congratulations on the book, and thank you for sharing it with us and sharing a bit of time talking about it.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.